Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Search up ABC Pacific Prepared to listen online or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
In Papua New Guinea, rugby league isn't just a sport. It's the heartbeat of a nation.
Rugby league is our number one sport. If there is anything that unites our country, it is rugby league.
But behind the tackle bags, behind the painted faces, is a political deal that could change everything.
Papua New Guinea has been awarded the right to join the NRL in the 2028 competition.
A deal to bring PNG's own team in the world's biggest rugby league competition, the NRL. But at what cost? Hi, I'm Scott Whiteday, and this is Polytalk, the show that takes you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and the people it shapes. Today, the politics, the pride, the promise of Papua New Guinea's NRL bid. In PNG, rugby league isn't just a game. It's a religion. In the towns, the villages, the settlements, it brings people together. And no one knows better how deep the love of the game runs than Michael Marum, the governor of PNG's East New Britain province and a rugby legend.
I played in the early 90s back in Port Moresby. There I went as far as playing for the Kumus, played four test matches for the country, and also took part in two World Cup sevens in Sydney 2014, coached the Esperantas, and also was assistant coach to PNG Kumus. And then 2016-17, I was also head coach Kumus.
Michael Marum's list of rugby league achievements is long and has reached the heights of the sport in PNG. Like many Papua New Guineans, his love for the game started at an early age.
Basically, when I was a kid growing up, I used to follow my parents around Rabaul town, watch a couple of football matches every weekend. And uncles were back then playing, so wanted to hang around them. You know, carry their boots around.
Michael grew up in the 1970s, the decade when PNG first became part of the Rugby League International Federation. In the 1980s, PNG's MTV television station started broadcasting Australian NRL matches.
Well, they're serving up some entertainment here because this is fantastic.
In 1998, one of Papua New Guinea's own, Marcus Bai, joined the Australian NRL team, the Melbourne Storm. For a generation growing up watching rugby league on TV, Marcus Bai became an inspiration. But his debut in the National Rugby League was a rarity when PNG had no set pathway for NRL entry. And for decades, PNG's rugby league teams were considered the underdogs. Until 2014.
2014, admission of the Hunters into the Queensland Rugby League competition. We proved that we were competitive enough to face the best around Queensland and Australia.
Michael Marum had switched from playing rugby league to coaching it. And over 3 years, he coached the PNG Hunters in the Queensland Cup and took them from the rugby field to the history books when in 2017, in a tough battle against the Sunshine Falcons, and with time on the clock running out, the PNG Hunters won their first minor premiership.
To present to you the 2017 Entrust Super Cup to the captain of the Hunters, Asai Boas.
Yes, Alty, I'm here with the winning coach, Michael Murray. Michael, can you believe it?
But the win was tinged with disappointment for his players, knowing that they couldn't yet progress to the higher tier of rugby league.
At the time we thought, you know, a lot of our players would have made it to the NRL. Because normally when you're the best team in a competition, you win a competition, and normally the next year you lose players. But we didn't have a pathway ahead.
So the idea of a Papua New Guinea NRL team remained a dream. And Michael Marum left rugby league and moved into politics, becoming the governor of East New Britain province. For years, all was quiet on the NRL front until 2024, when huge news sent shockwaves throughout the country. PNG and Australia had struck a historic deal.
Papua New Guinea has been awarded the right to join the NRL in the 2028 competition after months of negotiations.
At a press conference to announce it, the Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, hailed the deal as a major strategic victory.
I'm delighted to announce the Australian government is supporting a PNG team to join the National Rugby League competition from 2028. Rugby league is PNG's national sport, and PNG deserves a national team. The new team will belong to the people of Papua New Guinea. It will call Port Moresby home, and I know it will have millions, literally, of proud fans barracking for it from day one.
PNG's Prime Minister James Marape told the ABC that this long-awaited dream would unite the country.
Well, rugby league is our number one sport. If there is anything that unites our country, it is rugby league. Politics divide. We have a diversity of culture, the most diverse nation on face of planet Earth, over 836 languages with their own set of culture in a nation that is as diverse. Rugby league unites, so that is a national uniting sport for us.
Under the deal, Australia's government will give $600 million over a decade to help make the team a reality. In return, Papua New Guinea has agreed to sign what has been called a parallel agreement on strategic trust between the two countries, which is designed to stop China from gaining a significant security foothold in the Pacific country. For Michael Marum, the money holds a lot of promise.
Yeah, no, I think 600 million is a lot of money, but again, it's just over 10 years. It's 60 million per year. You know, I would love to have some of that money invested in infrastructures across the province as well. Yeah, we'd like to see some of that money come back to a couple of other provinces that are probably capable of hosting big events like that.
But in a country where people suffer from high unemployment, a health system in crisis, and failing infrastructure, some question whether that money should be going towards a sports team.
My name is Oliver Nobetal. I am the project director of the Australia-Papua New Guinea network over at the Lowy Institute.
Oliver Nobetal knows that this NRL deal has been a long time coming.
Been over a decade since the PNG, or the concept of putting a PNG team or a PNG franchise in the NRL was started, and slower steps were sort of made to that, made towards this, and sort of progressing towards it. We had sort of the introduction of the Prime Minister's 13, the annual match between the PNG representative side as well as Australia's. And we also had the introduction of the PNG SB Hunters in the Queensland Cup as well. So this is sort of a natural progression moving forward, and the sort of the final stage of what really the PNG NRL bid had wanted.
But now that it's a reality and hundreds of millions of dollars are set to be pumped into the sport, he says people are questioning whether it's the right move.
A lot of people have been asking these questions. Why put so much money into an NRL franchise of all things, when it seems to be that the priorities for what PNG really needs on the ground is quite different? Certainly everyone has their own views on how this could be spelled out, but when I had initially written a paper and me and some of my colleagues had run the numbers, it was clear that, you know, 600 million could contribute to a significant amount of infrastructure in the health and education sectors within the country.
Oliver, what was the response in PNG to this deal?
Yeah, look, I think it was a mixed bag, you know, and there was mixed responses, right? And unfortunately, we don't in PNG. What we don't do very well is being able to sort of host, have a bit of like a public poll, right, to see really what is the public opinion of any sort of issues or policy issues at a time. So what you really can do is just gauge by what you come across, and really where you find that is where you go and shop for opinions, is all on social media, right? In the absence of, I guess, more formal platforms where people can air their views, that's sort of where people run to. So you've got LinkedIn, you got your Facebook. So there was a mix. Some people are quite happy about it. You know, they felt that this is something a long time coming. This is something that PNG deserves. It's a good sort of 50th birthday present from, you know, its former colonial administrator. Other people were quite frustrated in the sense that, you know, it seems like a bit of a slap in the face, and it's almost, I've seen some people say that it's almost like an insulting gesture, you know, 600 million, but to go to a rugby franchise. Now, that while there may be benefits, and while there may be large benefits, it seems to me that they would be concentrated within a smaller group of people. The amount of people receiving these benefits, or the beneficiaries, will be much smaller than if the money was redirected to other sort of development initiatives, like, say, in health or education.
Now, James Marape has said that the sport can promote social unity. What do you think of this idea?
Before, you know, the NRL bid was signed, I thought that that was a bit of wishful thinking. And we had, you know, the emerging leaders dialogue with some really inspiring young leaders from PNG and Australia. And we talked about youth, and then we also talked about sport. And then after sort of considering what is being said, I think it can be a driving factor, you know, as a unifying factor. That being said, I don't think it's the only thing, and I don't think it's the only thing that should be relied on. I think greater thought has to be given, and sort of there has to be smarter initiatives taken to understand why there is disunity in the first place. I don't think that there's disunity because people are mad that there's no National Rugby League team. And if you would have seen the newspapers on that day, the day after the rugby league team was announced, there was a social media was blowing up with some conflict just happening at Togarara over in Port Moresby, right? So it was clear that this one wasn't, it wasn't something that will fix it overnight. But I think it can do its part to try and help with unity, but it's not going to be the only thing. And I think the government needs to do more to try and actually understand what is it that's causing the sort of disharmony and disunity. And then when you can figure that out, then you can really figure out what to do to address it.
What do we know about the breakdown of this money, the 600 million that's going towards funding this?
The money thing, I think, is what needs to be explained further. Fox News had reported on a breakdown of the funding, and it was bundled up as of the 600 million, 60 million being spent on the license fee to the other 17 clubs ahead of PNG's inaugural season, and the remaining $540 million then being shared in PNG between the football operations, which was supposed to be 290 million, and the education and social welfare programs, such as like the development pathways, which is going to be 250 million. So that's really the broad breakup of how this deal would look like. But there has to be sort of greater understanding on really how this money will be implemented.
What are your thoughts on the argument that this money could have been allocated not to developing a sport, but to aiding PNG in other areas?
I think an important thing to get across is that you see a lot of blame coming on both sides, right? So some people will blame the PNG government, saying that, you know, you're prioritizing the wrong things. And some people will blame the Australian government, saying, why are you putting money into this when, you know, this is what we need? We need more development stuff, right? I think the biggest thing that people need to understand is that any sort of geopolitical dealing or engagements that we sort of undertake, not just now going into the future, but over recent time, it's a demand driven process, right? So there is no party coming to the table with an upper hand per se. One might have more resources on what's being offered, but the receiving country is one that has to accept it. So with that being said, I think it's an indication of the PNG government's priorities, right? And this is sort of where they see the priority of the money, where it should go. Now, on where this money could have gone instead, technically, yes, it could have gone to development funding. It's important to note that the 600 million itself is not taken out of Australia's development aid budget. So this is money that sits externally. So we're not sacrificing any existing development programs, and we're not sacrificing existing development funds that are currently being provided by Australia. But then it goes back, looping back around to what I had said earlier, then the question that remains is, if there was momentum to garner $600 million towards a rugby franchise, why can't we use that same sort of momentum and that same enthusiasm to put $600 million again into these education and health and, you know, development programs?
Can you describe your view on how this deal could set a precedent for other deals that misalign with PNG's domestic needs?
If anything, I don't think that this one is sort of setting the precedent. I feel like this is probably the result of other deals that have already been set before. So if anything, it's an indication of a trend that might continue to happen if nothing is done to sort of try and realign with the priorities of really the PNG people and the struggles of everyday Papua New Guineans.
Where does the accountability lie when it comes to matching money where it's needed, the donor or PNG government, and why do you think that?
So the geopolitical engagements that are happening within the Pacific region are very much a demand-driven process, right? A donor is offering, you know, its resources, and the recipient government, whether it's PNG or another Pacific country, they decide where to funnel that money to. So it's really much it's an offer and acceptance between both governments, between a donor and the sort of recipient government. So in terms of accountability, they are to an extent both accountable. But then the question I think the question that a lot of people would ask is, how do we increase accountability? And how do we get these deals to be more transparent? And there's no one quick solution, and there's no sort of solution to each deal that comes through. I think there has to be a broader sort of reform or broader sort of engagement by ordinary Papua New Guineans to understand that they also have a role to play in holding their government to account.
Can you elaborate on that more?
Yeah, I'll sort of put this into context. A lot of the issues why people say that, you know, democracy might be failing within PNG, there's a significant dynamic or significant stakeholder that needs to be participating more, and that is the average Papua New Guinean. And I guess, you know, I would draw the analogy saying that PNG life currently has a duality of systems in a society that sort of govern society, right? So we have customary practices, and then we also have sort of a Westminster system of governments, like a Western model of democracy that governs our lives. Both of these systems govern our lives. For the traditional system that we have, you know, we follow leadership structures that are given to sort of chiefs, tribal leaders, you know, leaders of clans and tribes. And the underlying rule for these traditional systems and why they survive and why they still sort of maintain today is that ordinary persons are not supposed to question the authority in power. That's seen as a sign of disrespect, and that's something that is taught to Papua New Guineans sort of at a very young age, and that's sort of the system that we grow up learning, and we translate that into the household as well, into parents, sort of, you know, respecting parents and not questioning sort of the authority. The problem with that is you can't transpose that into democracy, because the only way that democracy can work is if you do question authority, and you question authority when it comes to election times. You question them for every single policy decision that they make. That's the only way that it will work. So it's the system itself, where the system itself isn't necessarily bad, but I don't think it's complete. Because ordinary Papua New Guineans need to get more involved, right? Now, there's a difficulty in the PNG sense. It's not just easy. It's not an easy way of just saying, just sort of yelling at your member and asking them or telling them they're doing the wrong thing, right? I think there's an absence of formal platforms and avenues where this should be done, and that's something that needs to be worked towards moving forward, so that other deals, as we're talking about, you know, where there might be misalignment, there's a way to sort of correct that misalignment and realign it to the priorities of the people on the ground.
As Oliver outlines, there are things bigger than this sport at play here. In Papua New Guinea, culture and colonialism are constantly bumping up against each other. Rugby league is part of PNG life because of the colonialists who arrived 100 years ago. And although Papua New Guineans have now made it their own, the clash between culture and colonialism manifests in other ways. In the struggle of democracy, frustrations with governance, and in the push and pull between tradition and imported systems. But this hasn't stopped many who love the game from still being thrilled about what it'll mean for rugby league in the country. Like Della Audama, a former PNG Orchids rugby league player, who is working with the PNG NRL as a female high-performance coordinator.
Yes, so rugby league is currently the national sport of PNG.
Della says that over the course of her career, rugby league has been a lifesaver for her.
I'm really a type of person that doesn't want to do anything but hang around and don't listen to people. But when I started playing rugby league, I see that it shaped me to be a better person. I stopped going out and partying, and it started to shape me to look after my health.
And that the game was a way to provide for her family and support herself.
One of my aspirations was my mom. So my dad passed away early, and I see that I'm not educated and I have no way to support anyone, but I see rugby league as there's ways to get some support, not only financially, but like different type of support you can get around the rugby league community. So with that support I got, I know that if I stay long enough, I'm going to still look after my mom.
Della, what do you think about the deal for PNG to enter the NRL?
Like my personal thoughts is if we can invest a lot in the programs in PNG, we have to invest a lot for local programs here, because it's a PNG team, and we have to have facilities built here in Port Moresby, and so we can have that academy or development program consistent throughout the whole season. Yeah, so developing our local like players and staff is very important.
A PNG National Rugby League women's team has also been put on hold following the announcement of the deal for the men's team. But officials have said they want to eventually have a women's team join. How do you hope the money from the current deal will help the development of women's rugby league in the country?
Oh, it will really help not only rugby league players, but a lot of young girls who are at the stage where it's either I go to school and go back home, or it's either I stay home and wait for my mother and father to come back. And like, if I'm not in school, I'm just at home. It will help a lot of girls who are at the stage where they are confused in life. This is where I want to be. They're just going to come and be part of the sport. At the moment, no, the girls are like, okay, I want to play rugby league, or I want to play a sport, but where am I going to go? They're confused, especially outside of the cities. So it will really change a lot of lives, especially in females.
There are big hopes and big dreams for the NRL deal, and big questions. PNG's Prime Minister James Marape believes joining the NRL will unite the country. And rugby league legend Michael Marum agrees.
Yeah, I think we it's going to unite the people together.
He says he's seen it happen before when the PNG Hunters won the Queensland Cup back in 2017.
Back in 2017, we won a cup. We were playing last time. People were shouting, you know, the old town, the old, you know, where I come from, the local village. No one goes to church. Everyone's told there. Everyone's yelling, crying. You know, there was this. Yeah, so this is going to unite, put everyone to unite the full PNG. Not only PNG, but the other people that live here and call PNG home.
But for Oliver Nobetau, he hopes Papua New Guineans will dig a bit further for answers from their leaders.
I don't think that there's disunity because people are mad that there's no National Rugby League team. And I think the government needs to do more to try and actually understand what is it that's causing the sort of disharmony and disunity. And then when you can figure that out, then you can really figure out what to do to address it.
As the country chases its dream of joining the big league, it's also grappling with deeper questions about who gets to lead, who gets heard, and what kind of future it wants to build. The game may be rugby league, but the stakes go beyond the field. Polytalk is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kunta Murray Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna. Next week on Polytalk, Emmanuel Marshall studied medicine at Fiji National University and is now a lab technician living in New Zealand. And in January 2025, he had to quickly fly back to Fiji when his grandfather fell extremely sick.
It hurt me a lot to see the type of health care that he had in Fiji. It hurt me because I flew over to Fiji and he was admitted at the hospital, and the state of the hospital was something that I would never wish on anyone. It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning, which is termed as septicemia, in the hospital, and he needed antibiotics for that. And that was not available at the time, which was needed for him. And the answer we got was that it's not available at the warehouse. So we were asked to buy it privately. And I was fortunate enough to be able to afford that antibiotics because it cost me close to around $500 a vial, which he needed to have every 8 hours infused in him. And he needed to have it for 14 days. So you could imagine the amount of money it cost me. And good enough for me, I'm able to afford it. But I felt sorry for the patients next to him. It came to a point in time where the nurses came around on a ward run and asked me, excuse me, sir, do you have any extra? And then asked why. And they said, there's a baby in pediatrics that needs it. And it was just sad to be in that kind of state, really.
Across the Pacific, access to everyday medicines can be notoriously hard to get. In Fiji, it's particularly bad. And the doctors say they are at breaking point.
So, like, for example, it's reached the state where we've got very, very senior clinicians, in fact, clinicians who taught me when I was in medical school, saying that they've never come across this situation before where they have to prescribe IV fluids and give it to the patient to go to the pharmacy and purchase the IV fluids, because the Ministry of Health facilities were out of normal saline. We've got bandages out of stock. We've got a paracetamol out of stock, some basic antibiotics, some penicillins out of stock. So the prescription now has to be given to the patient to go ahead and purchase it from outside. Well, we're getting feedback from our members in that they're feeling very handicapped almost because of the shortage of medications and medical consumables. They are unable to carry out their duties to a standard that any healthcare system would be comfortable with, and they've had to cut many corners. And obviously, once you start cutting corners in health, you start to breach patient safety and quality care.
But why is this happening?
Politicians, particularly ministers of health, get into their appointment 3 years, 4 years if they're lucky, and move on. Many of them come into the role clearly uninformed, don't know the issues. And so they don't really understand the complexity of these things and what's going to make the difference for health.
That's next week on Polytalk with me, Scott Whitey. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.